And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has had extensive field work experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Georgetown Foundation's publications, among others. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And you're just back from Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, and the UN representative in charge of Syria has just, I think, quit in despair, Brahimi, also amid charges that the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons. And of course, Secretary of State John Kerry and his counterparts from European and Arab nations are gathering in London to discuss the future of Syria, which clearly is incredibly bleak. There are reports that the rebels are losing, but in effect, it doesn't look like the government is winning either. So what's your analysis?
Well, I would agree with the fact that it doesn't look like either side has a clear-cut pathway to victory. The best way to describe it is a strategic stalemate. While the Syrian military has managed to achieve the evacuation of fighters from the city of Homs, which is a very important and strategic city in central western Syria, it lies on the M5 highway, which runs north through several governorates from Damascus through Homs, to several core Assad-supporting governorates in coastal Syria. That evacuation also left those fighters to go to north of the city of Homs, to areas that are still under the armed opposition's control. The Syrian military is still only advancing on Aleppo in northern Syria at a snail's pace. It has lost control over most of eastern and northeastern Syria. In northeastern Syria, to the Kurds, who are moving steadily towards their own autonomy, and in eastern Syria along the Iraqi border to militant Salafist groups and tribal militias, a number of whom are affiliated either with Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a known al-Qaeda affiliate, or the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Shem, or the Levant, which is a splinter group from al-Qaeda, which is actively seeking to create an Islamic caliphate in the Levant. The Syrian regime is only now beginning to consolidate its core areas of support in western Syria and is trying to push through this elections process, which many observers, including many Syrians in the Assad-leaning areas of Syria, consider to be somewhat of a sham, resulting in his reelection. And that was the biggest issue that caused Brahimi to leave, was that he was tired, from his own statements that he's made, that he was tired of the process. The failures of the Geneva conference that occurred in late January and February this past year, and now with the announcement of the election in Syria, just the prospects of hope for some sort of negotiated settlement, which from the opposition side would have required the abdication of power of al-Assad at the bare minimum, most likely the total abdication of his regime, it doesn't seem to be a very strong prospect of hope for peace in the near term.
Well, it also doesn't sound like this conference taking place with Secretary of State Kerry and his counterparts in Europe in London, along with representatives from Arab nations. It doesn't sound like there's much harmony there, because on Tuesday, France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius criticized the United States and expressed regret that the Obama administration had decided against retaliating against the chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime last August, and which at the last minute, as you know, President Obama basically punted it to the Congress, I think in large part in response to pressure from the American public, who are dead against any more interventions following Iran and Afghanistan. But nevertheless, since then, Syria, even though they've given up most of their chemical weapons, they've also waged up to 14 chemical attacks. So as long as Russia's supporting them, it seems that Assad, in effect, that deal put Assad in the catbird seat, didn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, that's a great point. The al-Assad regime has been bolstered significantly by outside support, and from geopolitically and strategically by Russia and behind Russia, China, geopolitically also by Iran, but also in terms of tactically by Iran. The Iranians have helped facilitate the flow of arms and ammunition to the Syrian government. There are now credible reports that the Iranians have begun to provide the Syrian military with drones, which some of which were modeled after U.S. drones that had been flown in Iraq. The Iranians were instrumental in convincing Hezbollah to intervene militarily in Syria. The Iranians have also been instrumental in providing a means by which to organize and fund and train Iraqi, Yemeni, Saudi, and other Shiite nationals to go to Damascus to train, to network with each other, and to support the Assad regime. There's another dynamic here at play, and the opposition, the Syrian opposition, has still had difficulty creating a credible platform for a post-Assad transition, which has made a lot of communities that have either been neutral or nominally pro-Assad, typically minority communities, but also tribal groups within the majority Sunni population, urban Sunnis as well, wonder what is in store for them if Assad were to leave power. There's also been a push now from the Syrian opposition, the opposition that has tried to align itself with the United States and other anti-Assad countries, to ask for weapons, particularly anti-aircraft weapons, either shoulder-mounted or otherwise. And this has been a big point of debate, because the reality on the ground is in most areas of Syria where the armed opposition is powerful, they tend to be armed opposition groups that are either militant Salafist or Salafist jihadist groups like ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra, or groups that have belonged to the Islamic Front, which wants ultimately to create a state in Syria based on Sharia law. And there hasn't been one unified reaction to this conflict that would, A, put military pressure on the Assad regime systematically, or B, begin to establish on the ground in Syria, in some area that has been liberated from Assad government control, the proto, you know, the formation of a proto state that can lead to a transitional government.
Well, so in other words, the opposition, particularly the radical Salafist al-Qaeda type opposition, the ones that want to have a Sharia law, and there are various degrees of extremism within that grouping, they have actually been a huge boon to the Assad regime. They have kept a lot of the minority populations, like the Christians, on his side, because they have fear extermination if these people take over and install Sharia law. So at this point, given that it sounds like the U.S. and the West has missed its chance to get rid of Assad, at the same time, the opposition, at least the secular opposition, has been marginalized by the radical Islamists. And I guess, you know, is there any chance of any sort of what they call a flypaper strategy of somehow attracting all the crazies from around the world into one place and then killing them? I mean, at this point, I keep hearing reports from various Middle Eastern countries and Western countries that what they're afraid of is if this situation in Syria ever ends, all these crazies are going to come home to cause havoc. So maybe there's an incentive on the part of a lot of governments, whether they want to admit it or not, to keep this agony going.
That has certainly also been put forward by the Syrian opposition itself. You know, both ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra are believed to be promoting foreign jihadists to come and fight for their cause and to establish training camps. And there's further opportunities for networking for these individuals, particularly from countries in Europe and even in the Americas. The Assad regime, and this has been, the Assad regime does, in a cynical, cold sense, serve a purpose if that perspective was to be pursued, in that it is an ongoing military presence in Syria. It has the ability to directly attack these Salafist jihadist groups, and that in some respects, because there is no unified Syrian opposition that can provide both political and military presence throughout the country, that the one perspective that's been put forward is that the Assad regime may be the best of bad options. General Michael Hayden at a Jamestown Foundation event in December 2013 had made that public statement, and that quote was picked up throughout the Arab world in the Arab media press because it was one of the first instances of someone stating outright what had been sort of in everyone's mind, what had been in many people's minds, including people in the Arab world, because there's just a lot of uncertainty the way forward. The only certainty that there is right now is that you have a horrible humanitarian situation. You have approaching 4 million refugees in Syria's neighboring countries. That provides tremendous stress on countries such as Jordan and Lebanon for employment, for housing, for water, for providing food security, for political insecurity reasons. And over almost 10 million internally displaced Syrians, large stretches of the country that have been wrecked, a medical infrastructure that's been wrecked. It's just not a pretty picture. And there is a lingering fear of, you know, that great quote that has always been put forward, which is ungoverned space, and that if Syria becomes a massive ungoverned space in the heart of the Middle East, that this will eventually impact Europe, it will eventually impact Asia, it will eventually go further afield and impact the United States.
Well, Nicholas Harris, clearly Assad has, his forces have gone light on attacking the more radical elements like al-Nusra and ISIS, and they've gone after the Free Syrian Army for obvious reasons, that a secular opposition to him would be is what he most fears, because the extremist religious opposition have so discredited themselves. And you also, so if you've got the Free Syrian Army on the Jordanian border in the Daraa area, and this other group that you mentioned on the Turkish side, and you also have to add to that the Kurds, who essentially are responding to a fatwa against them from al-Nusra. They've turned into a fairly effective fighting force, have they not?
The Kurds have thus far into the conflict maintained their group identity and their group cohesion. The Kurds, prior to the conflict, prior to the uprising, had been denied many cultural rights. Some figures estimate that 150 to 300 Kurds that have been born in Syria didn't have Syrian nationality because of a nationality law that had been passed back in the mid-20th century. There were widespread reports of Kurds being discriminated against in different venues of Syrian public life. And now that the Kurds have begun to build a semblance of autonomy in the areas in Syria where they have a lot of presence, Hasaka governorate in the east, in an area of Raqqa governorate that borders ISIS-controlled territory and takes constant ISIS attacks, which is Kobani, and then in Afrin, which is an Aleppo governorate, that it will be difficult to roll back those gains. And the political domination of the PYD, the Democratic Union Party, in Syrian Kurdistan, which has strong links to the PKK, which is listed as a terrorist group in the United States and many other countries, and also the military power of the YPG, or the People's Protection Committees, which are aligned with the YPD, makes it difficult to reduce the influence of that party on the Kurdish areas, and also to reduce the influence of a Kurdish push for autonomy. And the Syrian opposition hadn't helped either. There were other groups that were forming in the Syrian Kurdish areas, such as the Jabhat al-Akrad, or the Kurdish Front, that had looked towards the FSA and that had joined the FSA in 2012. And there are very, very good reports and very good indicators that they were pushed away by the Arab Syrian opposition, out for what could be conceived as ethnic reasons. That pushed these groups into the arms of the PYD and the YPG, and made it more difficult now to get the Kurds to move off their basic demand, which is some form of autonomy within either an Assad-led post-revolutionary Syria or a post-Assad post-revolutionary Syria.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has had extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among others. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.